In other words, you're transmitting and you're going out of somebody else's antenna. Was that you?
That was me. I use one of the online remote ham radio services and use other, essentially rent out the radio to you. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I thought that was you. Yeah, very good. Speaking to some woman, that she's out in California, and she wants to work remote. She's really into CW, and she wants to, you know, to work European. You know, it's tough to get European stations. You don't have a decent antenna out in California. So anyway, the question that she had, see on CW. Have you tried? Well, have you tried CW? And is there any latency involved?
Usually for remoteamradio.com, which is a high-end service, usually there's very little latency, and essentially none. There's a lot less latency when you listen than when you listen on one of the free SDRs on the air. It works very well on CW, like 95% of the time. Go ahead, and most of their stations are on the East Coast, so. It's much easier to work Europe than from a West Coast station, and the contacts will count because, as I understand it, the DXCC accepts contacts meant from anywhere in the country. It's like I could use a West Coast station to work Asia. I don't, because it's more fun to try to do everything from someplace on the East Coast. I'm not even sure they have a West Coast station available, but you probably could find one. A friend of mine who runs 100-watt sideband only with a hamstick type of antenna on a ground floor balcony does work into Europe. You know, but it's tough. He's even worked Europe on 40 meters, worked some of the big contest stations. So it can be done, but it is a real challenge. Just as the West Coast stations can't understand what a challenge is for us to work into much of Asia. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's the problem that she has. No problem. You know, she's in San Francisco. No problem working anything out. She really wants to work. East Coast station, you know, Europe, into Europe. So this remote station that you use, is that located on the East Coast? Because that's what they would do. You know, you go through the internet and pop out on a similar station that you're using.
Well, yeah. There are a couple of them. There are, I think you look at remotehams.com, you can find some remote stations you can use for free. Remotehamradio.com charges you to use their stations, and they have stations, I think, largely up and down the East Coast and some in the Midwest and Mountain States. I haven't looked. I don't think they have anything on the West Coast now. I use, for the most part, in fact, pretty much exclusively their 100-watt stations running dipoles high in the air in very good locations, and that's a blast. But if you want to operate super stations and pay them a large rental fee, you can do it.
Okay, very good, very interesting. And yeah, I'm going to pass that along. I'll speak to her probably on Wednesday. Okay, very good. Thank you, Frank. WSN.
Okay, very good. Again, I'm AC2GS. This is the LimeWire Technical Net. We still have about 10, 15 minutes if anyone is so inclined. So if anyone has any further questions or comments or topics, I'm looking forward especially tonight's SpaceNet report. Paul's going to do a story on a new interesting particle in physics. And I'm always interested in particle physics. But if you have any other questions or comments before that begins, hit that push to talk and say hello. There is no one has any comments. Paul, I was very happy to see on your list of things you're going to discuss. You're going to discuss that that particle that CERN has been working on lately.
Yeah. I found the name of the particle, too. It's spelled XI-CC+. They got to come up with a better name. But, yeah, we'll cover that. The CERN group, you know, with the Large Hadron Collider has come up with this. Apparently this particle is somewhat, well, I think it's an up, well, they have an up and down gluon. I think it's something in that category. And it only exists for like 1/1,000,000 of a second. But this is definitely something new. I don't know if they're going to have to change their whole atomic model or not, but it's a weird particle. They said it's similar to a rubber band, you know. As the rubber band gets pulled further and further apart, the thing gets stronger and stronger. So we'll have to see what happens. I pretty much just started looking into it, so I don't know all that much about it. But this, I think it's it could be a game changer from what I was reading. Back to you, Mark.
Yeah, it's not gluons. Gluons, though, have that characteristic. So the farther you pull them apart, the more energy they have. Matter of fact, under normal energy conditions, if you insert enough energy to pull apart a gluon, you just get two gluons. The energy gets turned into an identical particle. This is not gluons. These are quarks. The proton is two up quarks and one down quark. This particular object, which is in the same family as a proton, but it's heavier, is when you take the two up quarks and exchange them for two charm quarks. So that's what the CC is. That stands for two charm quarks. So that's what that is. It's been theoretically recognized for, I think, 20 years. They just didn't have the amount of power to in CERN to actually create one. And as you mentioned, it has a half-life of 1/1,000,000,000 of a second. So it's not going to be around for very long.
Yeah, that's the interesting part. How do they know it was even there, you know? I mean, that machine could pick that up. I don't know if they used Atlas machine or, you know, one of those detectors. I just started looking into it. But they're making good use of 17 mile circumference thing that goes between two parts of France and Switzerland. You know, it's I don't know how it's going to benefit anybody. You never know until they figure out, you know, what they could do with this theory. And And then one point I read was they said it's four times heavier than something else, whatever it was. I don't remember. I'll have to go back to that article. But it's supposed to be heavy, actually a heavy particle. And, you know, how different is it than a proton? You're saying it's part of a proton? Is that what you're saying?
It's in the same family. There are proton-like particles out there, and the up quarks are the lightest quarks. So it's the lightest thing in the proton family. The charm quarks are a little bit heavier. I think twice as heavy, and so it has two charms. So it produces a heavier like particle. It has a positive charge like a proton has. It has the same spins and other values. It's just its mass is higher than a proton that uses up quarks as opposed to charm quarks.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, very good. We'll follow it along and see if they could look for this thing again. I wonder if, you know, to find proof, you're gonna have to do this test over and over again, I'm sure. You know, they can't just say, okay, this is it. You know, we got one picture, and then they're gonna have to do this over and over again, I would imagine.
Interesting point. I don't know. I mean, the article kind of led me to believe that they would be soon moving on to even more esoteric particles. John, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, thanks, Roy. AC2PL, Jeff. I don't think it's a coincidence that they're making this big announcement, which is, you know, interesting. Let's just say that. Immediately upon RHIC shutting down. Who else in the world is going to confirm it? Who knows?
Yeah, we live in strange times. Anyway, this is AC2GS. I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. Someone sat on his microphone. Anyway, it's been fun. I hope you learned some things, and I hope you'll come back next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. But it's 10:15 and change, so it's as good a time as any to have Paul come, WS2N, and present the SpaceNet report. Take it away, Paul.
Very good. Thank you, Roy. AC2GSWS2N, this is Space Report for the TACNET. Let me just go over something real quick that we talked about earlier in the net, see if anybody would be interested in an astronomy net that's going to be taking place on a regular basis in Australia. This thing is crappy. Noise on my radio for some reason, and I'm transmitting. There's going to be this astronomy net, and it's on a digital voice system. You know, they're going to use this wireless X room, the C4 FM system from Yaesu to do it. I know there's a few of those radios that do that. And apparently they're going to be taking check-ins Sydney time, 7:30. And it's by this fellow, Dr. Haas, BK2HSW. And they'll take questions. Apparently it's going to be like a regular net. So, you know, you'd be able to get into it if you if you know how to do this. And they call it a wise room. Let's see, wise X room, and they have a room number 24160. 24160. So, if anybody does it, I know, Roy, you said you're gonna try to give try one of these days and record it. That would be interesting. And very good. Let me just drop it. See if anybody has any comments. We're going to move on to a regular portion of the net. WS1.
Yeah, Paul, is that live X room accessible through the web? And I could probably figure it out, you know, off the top of your head, what that time is in GMT. Yeah.
I get a chance to convert the to UTC, but it's 7:30 Sydney time, so I probably find out in a couple of minutes. Put that into the web. Yeah, and I'm just looking to see if there's any other information I could have. They also have something called the YSF Yankee Sierra F. Yankee Sierra Foxtrot Reflector. I wonder if that would be helpful too. And that goes under the number 24160 also. So I'm not sure what that's all about. I do neither of those. I do CW and HF phone. My digital days long over. Although I still have an old TNC laying around somewhere. When he's a work amateur. Anyway, back to you, Frank.
Yeah, I had a TNC going, PK-232 going in my old station in the 1990s. It was a lot of fun. And a guy I grew up with built the TNC that flew on the space shuttle for quite a number of years. I think that was quite amusing when I found out about it. And from anybody else but him, I would have thought he was pulling my leg. But, I'm pretty sure that's accurate. Anyways, I remember that stuff. Yeah, my iPhone can do the conversion quickly enough, so I can figure it out. It's just a matter of figuring it out, how to access it, whether it's time of day I want to listen to it and try to get on. Anyway, go ahead, Paul. I have to step away from the echoing for a couple of minutes, so I may leave it connected. I may not be within earshot of the phone. Excuse me. WB2BXO.
Good. Yeah, whatever happened to Amptor? I feel like looking at the digital. It was two signals, and they kept going chirp, 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 and they get closer and closer. When they got close enough, you were good, and you were locked into that station only. You know, nobody else could jump in and and put their call in there until you were off. A lot of fun. Yeah, I just want to talk about the EVA that took place during the week. You had two astronauts go out on the International Space Station to work on the they called the ROSA. ROSA is an acronym for Rollout Solar Array System, and they throw an I in front of it for some reason. You know, it stands for International Rollout Solar Array, but it's a ROSA. The system, it's been very successful. This company has developed it, and they ran some early tests, I remember, and now it's become a mainstay on the International Space Station to actually replace or actually supplement the existing solar panels on the station. So you had two hams go out, Chris Williams went out. He's a ham. KJ5GEW, along with Jessica Meir. She's been up quite a few times. She does not have a call letter. But they went out, set up all these different stanchions, and they, you know, have to bolt up these triangular pieces that are eventually going to hold the ROSA system. And then I believe the next EVA will probably be the actual installation of this system. You know, they bolt it up, and then they release the tension on the rollout system, and it unrolls automatically. They have, you know, on the two sides of the panel, you know, for the whole length of it, it's like this flexible fiberglass material, and on the inside it's very stiff, and it's all rolled, you know, rolled to the tight. It's sort of like a 25-foot ruler. You know, if it got this spring action to it. So once released, it rolls out all by itself, and it stays there. So they've done this quite a few times over the years. What happens is the solar arrays that are there, you know, each one is like 40 feet long, around 40 feet wide and around 240 feet long. They start to deteriorate, and they lose a lot of the power that they force into the battery system. So to supplement that, they're adding these things. So basically, they're going from around 160 kilowatt system all the way up to 210 to 215. So they're adding quite a bit, you know, over the years, which involves a lot. I mean, they've actually changed out all these batteries over the years. They used to have this hydrogen type of system that they've done away with and replaced them with lithium ion system built by Japan. And, you know, they've flown them up there, and the lithium systems are twice as capable as the old systems. So, you know, they're actually smaller, and they have many more amp hours. So they've made some really very good upgrades to the space station. Which is weird because, you know, I cannot see them doing away with the space station, and now it's 2032. The space station was initially built. They said, okay, we're all going to be good for 15 years. So, you know, by 2015, 2016, that was going to be it. The years kept getting pushed back further and further. And year or two, they said, oh, that's it, 2030, they're going to cut it off. They just recently stretched it to 2032. So these solar panels are going to really come in handy. And I don't see any reason to get rid of the space station. You know, if a couple of modules fail or something, yeah, get rid of them and just bring up new modules. But the structure, the whole structure itself that's holding all the modules, it's extremely strong. All aluminum alloy system. These trusses, basically it looks like gigantic radio tower, that kind of a thing. It's all these triangular pieces. And they were set up initially section by section by section. In fact, there's a lot of these sections. Each one was brought up by another shuttle, you know, and then installed over time. Took collectively around 35 shuttle missions to do the entire space station with all these sections and then 15 or over 15 modules that are attached. And, you know, in the future, I think it's going to be a shame to do away with that space station. You take a look at, you know, them doing a spacewalk the other day, and you see these little tiny people, you know, in spacesuits, and this massive thing. I mean, it's like they're flying around the outside of a 40-story building. You know, it's that kind of a, you know, when you look at it, you say there's no way in the world that they should get rid of this thing. Over $100 billion to put it up there. Over a period, you know, all these years, the early launch was what, 1999, I think, was the first launch. And, you know, they started with the, functional car space. Essentially, it was like a machine room. That was the first module sent up by the Russians. And they kept adding after that, shuttle after shuttle, progress mission after progress mission, and amazing. And I believe they have a couple of more solar panels beyond this that they would do in the future. They weren't going to do them then, but it turns out they're so much better than the old system. So I think they added another contract to, you know, put a couple of these things up there. Okay, nothing heard. I just want to talk about this satellite system that European Space Agency launched a couple of years ago, about a year and a half or so ago. They launched it on a polar satellite system rocket from India. You know, India had the contract to put these two satellites up there. And they flew up together, and they followed one another. And what happened was they were going to use this for duplicating eclipses called Proba 3, P-R-O-B-A-3. And it's two satellites. One flies around, 100 or 200 meters away from the other one. And it has a corona graph on it, which is, you know, this dark thing, and it's got all kinds of electronics behind it, solar panels. So the solar panel faces the sun, and this corona graph, this round piece, I think it's around 5 or 6 feet in diameter, just sits there in space, and the other satellite, that's the one that looks at it. And what the other satellite sees is an eclipse all the time. Anytime they're in line with one another. And they have these fine-tuned measuring devices on, little laser things. They've got thrusters, you know, for adjustments to move in space, to set themselves up. But the fine-tuning, they have extremely fine little thrusters run on nitrogen, and they stay perfectly in line with one another. And every time I'm talking about them, they were lost, operating. Everything was fine, and once they were gone. So this 5-foot spacecraft and the other one were no longer communicating with Earth. Mission Control, by the way, Mission Control was down in Darmstadt, down in Germany. The space agency is not in Houston. But they looked for the satellite, and they had at one point thought it was lost. But they eventually did get a signal, and they realized that the solar panels were not getting a charge, but it was getting a little charge. And sure enough, at one point they were able to contact. But once they did, they started sending signals to have the solar panels adjust properly face to face the sun. And now they have a good charge on them. And I think they're back to normal, so they're going to be able to have real science coming back now. The coronagraph is back. The Oculus spacecraft, the Occulta spacecraft, is back in operation. So these two are doing good. Now, there's no way they could have sent another, like a rescue spacecraft up to do this, because the altitude that they sent these two were way out there, geosynchronous orbit. So there are 23,000 miles to the Earth. And, it's not along the equator, but, you know, it's 59 degree inclination. But, that's what they got to do. You know, they keep searching and using different methods to rescue these spacecraft. It's happened so many times over years. There's another one that I'm wondering if NASA is going to be able to make contact with. It's called the MAVEN spacecraft, going around Mars, I think, over 10 years. They've used it for a repeated system for the rovers on the surface of Mars. You know, they've used a couple of different Mars satellites to do that, and MAVEN was one of them. But MAVEN had its main purpose of, you know, its own science mission to, you know, detect the losses of the atmosphere of Mars, which they were doing for years. But this time, the spacecraft went behind the sun in relationship to us. So it was us, sun, spacecraft. It happened many times, but for some reason this time, they always lose contact with all the vehicles surrounding Mars and on Mars when this happens. And it usually lasts a week or so until it pops to the other side of the sun and then they regain contact. Maybe this time that didn't happen. So they're thinking that some kind of a miss signal was sent to it at some point, and the solar panels, again, weren't facing in the right direction. They believe it's in some kind of a spin now, but they haven't given up hope now. It's been out of contact for, looks like, a couple of months now. But NASA hasn't given up hope, and I guess they're figuring sooner or later maybe the panels will pick up enough energy from the sun to charge the batteries, and maybe they'll get lucky in there. Once they make contact, then they're usually pretty good. They're able to rescue these vehicles, which is really worth it. You know, if you spend, you know, a couple of million dollars for a couple of people to operate the equipment to look for this thing for weeks or sometimes months on end, it's a lot better than sending, you know, out another 100 or 200 million space to the planet. Any comments? WS2N. Okay, nothing heard. Look at this. Another thing that I had on the list was the NASA Quest
Anyway, I have this is a story about the X-59. It's called Quest. The goal of this X plane is to see if they can fly over land with little or no sonic. Now it's been under development probably, I guess I started reading about this probably about 7 or 8 years ago. But it's a very long, thin plane. It's got a nose. The nose is probably the same length as its fuselage. It carries one pilot. And once they get this thing up to speed, then they'll be able to really take measurements on Earth on how much noise it makes. The idea, of course, is if this works out, NASA is like an open source type of thing with things like this. Private companies would be able to, you know, take this technology and maybe develop their own, you know, a real commercial plane that could fly over land with little or no noise to bother people down below. So it's been under development. It's been in the air probably about 3 or 4 different times now. And each time they do it, they go higher and they go faster. I think a couple of weeks ago, they got up to around 230 miles an hour or so at around 20,000 feet. And now they're going to go like 25, 30,000 feet and a lot faster, you know, maybe 260 miles an hour and eventually 300 miles an hour. And so, and, you know, each time they're going to do another test over and over again until they can, you know, get to I think it's 1.4 times the speed of sound, probably, you know, 700 or 800 miles an hour. So looking forward to that day. I'm sure we'll have sometime during this year. And once they're able to get that speed, know that the plane is, you know, solid, they will start flying it over land, over a few towns, and then they'll be able to see what's going on down below. Right now, every time it goes up, they send up an F-16 with it. They fly that next to it, take pictures of it and all. But at some point, once this plane gets to us, to be able to qualify the at the proper speed, then it will be on its own, you know. And again, they'll probably do many, many flights with the X-59. So look forward to, you know, seeing what the results are. You know, Concorde flew for forever, you know, from the 1970s until they canceled it. It was too expensive. Of course, we're only allowed to go over the water, over the ocean. The system will be able to go over land. You know, there is a company called Boom. They're trying to develop a plane that that goes supersonic, but again, that would be similar to the Concorde, you know, only over the ocean. So we'll see. And by the way, that Boom name is just a terrible name for a plane. That would be like calling a brand new car. Let's pick a name. What should we call it? Let's call it Crash, you know. I never got that. Anyway, any comments about Quest, the X-59? Okay, nothing heard.
ABCDU.
Progress 2. Progress 92. Progress is a Russia on a regular basis. They've been Progress vehicles since
way before the International Space Station base, to send them up to Mir Space Station. And even before that, they send them up to the Salyut space stations that they had built, Salyut 7 and a couple of other ones before that. But this is called Progress 92. It's been docked to the space station for a couple of months now. Originally went up, sent 6,000 pounds worth of stuff to the space station. We have cargo vehicles that send up much heavier than that. We send Cygnus up, and we send Dragon up, and a new one by Japan, the HDVX cargo vehicle that sends up like 13,000 pounds of stuff. But progress is important because one of the things that they send up is fuel to be put into the International Space Station in case the space station has to get out of its way. It does have its own thrusters on the ZESR module, you know, the back end of the International Space Station. And that's always refueled by one of these Progress vehicles. So anyway, Progress the other day separated from the ISS, and we will see orbit over the South Pacific, like most of these planned burn up the orbit space station vehicles do. So yeah, just thought I'd bring that up. 92 gives you an idea of how many times this thing has gone up, resupplied to ISS. Any comments? Firefly is back in the news. Firefly company building a rocket that they've flown about four or five times, and I think half of them have failed, but this one was a success. They have government contracts lately. They launch out of California, Vandenberg Air Force Base. So this one went up last week. And they called the Alpha vehicle. And so, you know, so far so good. It's not a reusable vehicle. They use RP-1, which is, you know, really refined kerosene, liquid oxygen. And the idea is to mass produce these things to send up, especially if the government needs something up like right away. The goal of Firefly is to, with the Alpha vehicle, is to have government call them up, say we need a flight within 24 hours. We're going to send you a satellite, and we need to launch it. And they actually did that once as a test. And the deal was that they weren't informed when they were going to. Just the deal was we're going to call you up one day, and 24 hours later you have to launch. So that was successful. But they've had a couple of failures, and but now it looks like they're getting back on track, which is good. And they also are building, by the way, they have their own engines that they make. They're also building a bigger engine that they're in partnership with Northrop Grumman to launch from Virginia, from Wallops Island, Virginia. And it's a much bigger vehicle that Northrop Grumman is the same company that launches the Cygnus cargo vehicle. And they fly up to space all the time. They needed to have a contract with somebody to help build engines for their vehicle, and they chose Firefly. And that should be ready, I would say, maybe the end of this year. And it's the new Antares rocket. What happened years ago, I think it's got to be 8 or 9 years ago, at least. Antares went up with Cygnus cargo vehicle, and it only went up for about a minute or so and then exploded. And they blamed it on the engines that they were using at the time. You know, they had contracts with Russia. This was before Russia got involved with the war in Ukraine. And the engines, it turned out they're really no good. And we had bought them. Northrop Grumman bought them from Russia. And they had plenty of these things in stock. But that was it. They said, no more. We can't have this. So ever since then, they've been looking to build a new Antares rocket. And it's taken all these years to do it. But these that they're going to use are supposed to be very good by Firefly. So we'll see. As far as I'm concerned, if America has countless different vehicles to get to space, it's very helpful. You don't want to be stuck. And any comments for the net? This is WS2M. Okay, nothing heard. SpaceX is now gone way over the top. They now have 10,000 operational satellites in space. I think I mentioned a couple of weeks ago they were about to get to that number. And there's no stopping them. So, I don't know, I'm not a big fan of this idea of countless satellites flying in space, but, you know, there's nothing to stop them. They're friendly with the government. They should have different requirements. The LEO system by Blue Origin that they're putting up, they only require 3,200 satellites, which sounds like a lot. No, it's not 10,000 or more. And the reason for it is they're flying at a higher altitude. They also have a higher throughput, with bits per second. They're able to do it, so I don't know why they're letting SpaceX do what they're doing. SpaceX is flying at lower altitudes, which is a good thing, because a lot of their satellites failed. When they fail, they deorbit. It's a lot easier to deorbit from a lower altitude. But we'll see. Any comments? I just want to bring up the Space Launch System that has now left the vehicle assembly building, back in launch pad 39B, and they're prepping it ready for an actual launch. You might remember Artemis II was rolled out a couple of months ago, supposed to launch early February, February 6th, but then they went to late February and then early March. Now it's April 1st. They plan on launching, and they have a window of maybe about, I think, 8 or 9 days after that to take a launch if there's a delay, weather or some kind of technical issue. And this is the course of the launch. The crew of four that will go in the direction of the moon. It's not going to orbit the moon. It's going to pass the moon, about 4,000 miles past the moon, so it'll be the human beings that have ever been away from Earth. But then it'll sweep around the moon and do a free return. And that should
take 9 days from here to the moon and back. And then when I say back, they're going to wind up in the Pacific Ocean. So it should be interesting. The news will go from, you know, all this bad news that I see every time I turn the TV on to good news from April 1st on for the next 10 days. They have new spacesuits they want to test out. They're not going to do any EVAs, but they will test them. They want to know how good they feel in zero G. The spacesuits I'm talking about will be the ones that they eventually land on the moon with. They want to test that out. Don't know if they're going to be able to do that on this mission. If not, it looks like they're going to definitely do it on the Artemis 3 mission, which is planned to go around just around the Earth. And they're going to test out docking with the two vehicles, SpaceX, Starship. Want to dock with that and actually have a crew go inside and hopefully separate from one another and then eventually dock and come back together again. And they would like to do that as well with the other lunar lander being built by Blue Origin called Blue Moon Mark II. That's up there as well. They plan on doing that all on the same flight. We'll see. That's a year away. That'll be 2027 when Artemis 3 goes up. That was originally planned to land on the moon. That's now been canceled. Now you have two landings the following year. That would be Artemis 4 and 5. That's the present plan. Do that for 1 year. So I think they're whistling Dixie. I think they're going to be, there's always delays, but, you know, hopefully they can do it. They plan on eventually setting a moon base there. I can see that happening. They need to start mass producing these SLS rockets, Space Launch System rockets, and the Orion spacecraft. So they need to focus on doing that. And maybe, you know, if all goes well, you know, by 2030, you might eventually have the beginnings of a base on the lunar surface on the south pole of the moon. Any comments before we close? This is WS2N for the Space Network.
Hello, this is Jim.
A little early, a couple of minutes anyway, but thank everybody that contributed and stood by and listened, and hopefully we'll be back next week, and then every short time after that, a couple of weeks from now, we'll be talking about the actual moon mission that they're doing. Crew of four, three people on that mission are ham radio operators. Maybe Christina Cook will get a license before she goes. Anyway, back to you, Roy. Before I do that, we'll be back tomorrow night with Club InfoNet on these repeaters, and that will be followed by radio, by the Swap and Shop with George, and that will be followed by Radio Newsline. Roy, over to you, AC2GS, WS2M for the Space Net Report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
Very good. This is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the Space Net Report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. I hope you had fun. Hope you learned a few things. And I hope you'll join us next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. As always, a few words of wisdom from people who have passed off on this modal coil. Dick H2RW would end most of his technical nets with the advice to be kind to each other. It's always good advice. And I always like to remind people of good old hepatitis. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows, so keep your mind open to new ideas, but not so wide open that your brain pulls out. You're going to need it one of these days. Everyone, stay safe, be well, have a great week, enjoy yourself, and come back next Sunday at night at 8 p.m. when we will do this all over again. This is AC2GS formally closing this episode of the Limar Technical Net, and I will be clear after I say, Slava Ukraini.
Net time complete. W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. Mark InfoNet tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater.
W2VL repeater.